going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment. I'm Harold Fisher. The number of new coronavirus infections reached a new record today. More than 36,000 were reported by state health departments. That eclipses the previous single-day record of 34,203 set back on April 25th. Texas, Florida, and California had the most today, each state reporting more than 5,000 new cases. What has happened since the first cases hit Washington state in January? What have we learned here in the United States? What don't we know about this deadly virus? Well, tonight we try to answer those questions and many more with a COVID-19 information update. My guests are Dr. Ronald Wilcox with the Center of Infectious Disease with Howard University Hospital and Ambrose Lane, Chair of the Health Alliance Network and co-founder of the Black Coalition Against COVID-19. Lines are open if you have questions or comments about the coronavirus pandemic related to how you can stay safe and anything else you want to know about this disease. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can use the hashtag WHURFM to tweet us. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining the program.
Thank you for having me. Good evening.
Let me start with you, Dr. Wilcox. What is your reaction to these new numbers that just came out about an hour or so ago about more than 36,000 new coronavirus cases today?
It was to be expected, truthfully. I'm not surprised. The numbers are startling in the fact that they're so incredibly high. But we did expect a second wave to come on, especially with the states and the cities opening up again and people not practicing the social distancing that they should be.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said second wave, but infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci said just yesterday that we are still in the first wave. Do you agree with that?
It matters whether you look at it, which way you look at it. We did start seeing, you know, like places that have practiced a lot of social distancing and lockdown, such as in the D.C. area, we did see a drop over the past several weeks here in D.C. As we start to open up businesses and stuff, I do expect the numbers to start going up again. So you could consider maybe not full waves, but small hills.
And also, you know, the same with you, Mr. Lane. Your thoughts about these new numbers coming out today?
Well, you know, it's unfortunate, and unfortunately, we were never set a good example by the leadership of this country. You often find on TV or through the news that our leaders are not wearing masks, they're not social distancing, and I'm speaking of the president and the vice president. And so they were not leading by example. The second thing is you had a number of states that never really shut down. They might have slowed down, but they never really shut down. They never shut down the way that D.C. and New York and some other places have shut down. So, you know, like Dr. Fauci said the other day, we're still kind of, in some of those states, steadily rising. And even though the rise was a little bit slower maybe a month ago, and now it's picked up now that many of those states or some of the ones that did shut down reopened fully, or the ones that didn't shut down are just experiencing a surge.
And one other thing that I want to ask both of you about, this is another one of the headlines coming out of the coronavirus news today, and that is the tri-state area, New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, now issuing a travel advisory for people who are visiting those states from the COVID-19 hotspots, Texas and Florida among them. We may remember earlier in the pandemic, approximately 2, maybe 3 months ago, that Florida's governor was saying that anyone who comes from, for example, New York may have to quarantine. Well, now that script has been flipped. Mr. Lane, is that political or is that a health issue, the new news today?
I think it's actually a health issue, but it's very difficult to try to corral interstate travel, I mean, especially by car. You certainly can do things when you go to an airport, but it's hard to do that by car, or it's hard to do that by train. So even though he said it, he's actually warning people that are living in New York as well to beware of people that are traveling from these hotspot states, and just making his state aware. But I think that, unfortunately, you know, we have interstate travel. We have states that are open, and, you know, we have people that are relatives of those that live in New York. And unfortunately, it's bringing the virus with them, even though New York has steadily decreased in its number of COVID-19 cases, both in terms of the number of positive cases and in the number of deaths.
Dr. Wilcox, do you think that travel advisory for the tri-state area is going to help, hurt, or not matter?
Truthfully, I don't think it will make a whole lot of difference. Like the other gentleman mentioned, I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Ambrose Lane. Go right ahead.
Mr. Lane, thank you. Mm-hmm. As he was saying, because of all the different ways that people travel, I don't really see that it's going to make that much of a difference. I agree that it would probably be more of an advisory for the people that live within the states that are issuing it, that maybe they shouldn't be having visitors come to them from those areas. But I don't think any kind of restrictions would make much of a difference.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. This is a COVID-19 update. We're trying to take a look at what we've learned since the first cases hit the United States, and also take a look at what we don't know and what we need to do to make sure that we stay safe during the midst of this pandemic. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Let's talk to Carmen calling from Upper Marlboro. Carmen, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'm a postal employee. I work at the post office, and the carriers don't practice the social distancing or the wearing of the mask. And like you said, our leaders don't do it. Our postmaster doesn't wear a mask or gloves. My supervisors don't wear masks or gloves. I work at the window, and I ask that if anybody comes up to the window, they at least have their mask on. And we're asked that the customers wear their mask, too. We're supposed to have a 10-person capacity in our small lobby. And every day for the past couple months, I've been the only one asking people to step out and wait for someone to come out before they came in. I spoke to my coworkers, and I said, we have to be a team here. I can't be the only one policing for all of us. We all need to do it together. And they refused to do it. And then I told them, I said, if you can't do it, then if there's more than 10 people, I'm going to step aside. I'll step out until it's less than 10. Well, they won't do it, so I start stepping aside. And then it came to the supervisor's attention that I was doing that. She told me, don't do that. Come and get her if there's more than 10 people. And I said, well, how am I going to come get you when you don't wear a mask? She said, I'll put it on when I come to the window.
Interesting. So let me see if my guests can address this issue, not only obviously the health issue, but, you know, the
– well.
Go ahead.
I did get a lecture today about it, and I told him I'm concerned about our safety and mine, and I was told by the postmaster, if you're so scared, take the COVID-19 leave.
Mr. Lane.
I'm not trying to do that. I'm trying to just come to work and be safe. And they kept arguing with me and said, don't come back then if you're scared.
Well, Carmen, let me see what my guests want to share about that. Mr. Lane, you first.
Employers are putting employees in between a rock and a hard place in many different instances. There is no mandated wearing of masks by the governor or by the District of Columbia. And it puts workers, especially essential workers. So if you can't wear a mask at work, and they're not going to practice social distancing, and you have others of the public that you're coming into contact with, you know, it raises the risk. And so, you know, I know that the doctor can certainly talk about those risks, because there are risk factors associated with COVID-19, and if you have any of the of certain conditions, it is much easier for you to contract COVID-19. So the employers are not protecting the employees, and I find that just you know, ridiculous, to be honest with you. I mean, we're not taking into consideration the health of the employees. We're not taking into consideration the health of their families. And so, you know, what would wearing a mask actually do? It wouldn't make workers less productive. It would actually give them some peace of mind that they would not only be able to spread it themselves, but it would be harder for them to contract it if they're wearing a mask. So, and if they're social distancing. So I don't see, you know, unless it's just an ego power kind of thing by employers, I don't see the reason why they wouldn't allow people to wear masks.
Dr. Wilcox.
No, I 100% agree with Mr. Lane and his points. I think those are excellent. Definitely, I think it amazes me that a business such as the post office would not be encouraging its employees who work with the public to take appropriate measures that are being recommended by the top public health people in the United States. That it just kind of floors me, and I agree. It's a defect coming from the top. Whenever our leaders, including the head of the post office, like you mentioned, if they're not believing in the science and they're not encouraging what the lead physicians and medical professionals are saying, it's hard for people underneath them to really enforce those rules.
And I think there may be two issues at play here. And Mr. Lane alluded to the issue. One is the health issue, Dr. Wilcox, but also there's a psychological impact here when we understand that the coronavirus is out there. There are some people who obviously feel more strongly about it than others. But the reality is, whether it's the post office, which again, I'm incredulous that, you know, a federal government office where you have people who need to congregate every day, the employees would not take that seriously. But I just think, Dr. Wilcox, that those two issues, the psychological and the literal impact, it can be an unfortunate combination during these difficult times.
No, I agree that combination can be more than just unfortunate. It can be deadly in its own way.
I want to thank our caller, Carmen, for giving us a call and sharing that with us. And please do the best that you can to make sure that you are safe. I appreciate your phone call. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. This is a COVID-19 update. We're taking a look at where we are after the pandemic hit the United States. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Let's talk a little bit more about, you know, what has been happening since, for example, this region, the DMV, has moved from the complete shutdown to phases one, phases two. DC is now in phase two. Virginia will be in phase three on July July 1st. Maryland doing very much of the same. Dr. Wilcox, do you believe that we are going about this the right way, and that the high number of infections are just the casualties of fighting this war?
I mean, I don't think, truthfully, I don't think the shutdown will prevent the overall number of deaths being different over the whole pandemic. I think what the shutdown and social distancing does is it slows down the rate of new infections, and therefore keeping us from overwhelming the medical system again. At Howard University Hospital, a month and a half ago, we were packed to the gills. I mean, our ICUs were overflowing. We had to open new ICUs. We had to open floors that hadn't been used for years for the number of patients that were coming in. The shutdown and the slowdown definitely was able to help us be able to sustain services. I think overall the number of deaths over the entire pandemic probably won't make that much of a difference.
Real quick before I go to a break, your thoughts about how things are being handled, Mr. Lane?
Actually, I give the mayor of D.C. pretty decent marks for the handling of COVID-19. There are certainly, as a health advocate, there are certainly some things I wish that had been done that have not happened, such as doing the type of testing in the congregated spaces, such as public housing, such as nursing homes, certainly in for those that are incarcerated. I certainly think that more targeted or universal testing should have been done. But overall, I would have to give the mayor higher marks. Nothing is going to be perfect. I don't think any mayor would have gotten it perfect. But nonetheless, we're on the downward trend, and the rate of infection is on the downward trend as well. It's not where it certainly needs to be, but it is moving in that direction. So, I do think that it's been a good job overall. Contact tracing, that's another issue where D.C. is ramping up the contact tracing.
Well, hold your point. Hold your point if you can, Mr. Lane. I need to take a really, really quick break. I also want to remind our viewers that tomorrow we do have a special edition of the Daily Drum, Young, Gifted, and Frisked, the resurgence of stop and frisk policies with the police departments. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. The original Quiet Storm is next on WHUR. This conversation continues on Sirius XM Channel 141 in just a few seconds. Shaw calling from Arlington. We're going to talk to you next. 202-319-7810. We'll be right back.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, Sirius XM Channel 142, HBCU, and Sirius XM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, we have a COVID-19 information update. We're asking, what do we know? What do we need to find out to defeat the disease and keep us safe? My guests are Dr. Ronald Wilcox with the Center of Infectious Disease with Howard University Hospital, and Ambrose Lane, Chair of the Health Alliance Network and co-founder of the Black Coalition Against COVID-19. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Before I go back to the phone lines, Mr. Lane, you were talking about contact tracing. Go right ahead.
Yes, and I would say that I think that the district and the Department of Health are getting their legs under them on the contact tracing piece. It's starting to move in a positive direction. I was a little worried at first about cultural competency in terms of those that are doing the contact tracing. But I think that they're getting their legs under them. But there's a couple points that I want to certainly make.
Sure, go ahead.
There are more than 14 strains of COVID-19. People need to understand there are more than 14 strains. And one of the more recent strains, a strain called D614G, that mutation is so far the studies have shown that it is actually more contagious than the previous strains. It's not more deadly, because all of them are deadly, but this one is more contagious than the previous strains. And so when we talk about protection, we have to talk about not only the contact tracing, but we also have to talk about wearing masks. And that's one of the things that we talk about both at the Health Alliance Network and with the Black Coalition Against COVID. And so I can talk more about that, about wearing masks and the campaign that we are having right now to get people to wear masks called I Mask for DC. And it's a video festival and competition that is happening actually this week. And so, we've had entries. There's no more time for entries, but we're trying to encourage people to wear masks to protect both themselves and to protect others. And that's one of the protective factors that we can do during COVID-19.
Let me go back to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Shaw, calling from Arlington, Virginia. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you, panel. My question is, or more of a comment, is that we see in Europe has been able to bend the curve. We see that in Asia. Even in Africa, we see that, for Christ's sake, by practicing the social distancing and the mask. We see that works. Why is it so difficult for us to do that in the United States? This is it baffles me. It baffles me. Beyond leadership, forget leadership. We know, forget the idiot we'll call president. Forget him. you know what I'm saying? I mean, whoever listened to him, that's their problem. But this is just ridiculous. And I'm hoping that whatever we're doing in the D.C. area, hopefully we don't rush into it. We'll see other states that rush into it. See, it fails. If you rush into it, it failed. China, everywhere else. Let's just take it easy and take it slow.
Well, let me see what Dr. Wilcox, what can be done? And Shaw, thank you so much for your passionate phone call. Dr. Wilcox, why are we still seeming to have a great deal of difficulty with bending the curve, as they say?
I think a lot of it, like South Korea and some of the places that were mentioned, they're used to the government having a lot more influence over people's day-to-day lives. Americans are very
hard-headed,
nicely
hard-headed, yes,
self-interested. They like to make their own decisions about everything, not necessarily thinking about what's best for the public as a whole, but instead just thinking about what's best for them as individuals. And so I don't ever see that our society would really be that accepting of a lot of the stuff that really will make a difference in this pandemic. You know, a lot of these measures I just really don't see. Like, I'm sorry, one of the new things is contact tracing using phone apps. That was something that's been done in some of these other places. And I've noticed that it's actually like showing up on my iPhone. I haven't turned it on, but it's one of the things that I just can't see most Americans accepting the idea of this phone app to be used as a contact tracing mechanism.
Let's talk about that for a little bit. I have an iPhone. Where is it?
It's in your settings section. I think it's under medical, if I remember right. It was recently put on there by Apple. In one of the updates, you have to turn on the app. So it's not something that, you know, they didn't put it on and then suddenly start monitoring you. You have to choose to participate with the app.
Mm-hmm. Shaw, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with that. Mr. Lane, two things. Your thoughts about the contact tracing app and cultural competency, because you mentioned that before as it relates to contact tracing. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Okay, so let's talk about the app first. First mm-hmm. of all, African-American disposition towards government is non-trusting from the very beginning. I mean, you know, all we have to do is look at the history of African-Americans in this country, look at the history of experimentation on African-Americans. I mentioned Tuskegee. We could talk about Henrietta Lacks. We can talk about a number of different instances in which the government participated in experimentation and giving wrong information to African-Americans. And so there's a reason why we are skeptical and not trusting of government. So when someone says that we're going to give you an app, and the app is to trace all of your contacts, are you serious? I just don't see it. Okay, so the other thing about the cultural competency. So when a person is trained to be able to do contact tracing, when you have a stranger calling you, and again, look at the background. The background is that we're not exactly trusting of government anyway. But you have a stranger calling you, doesn't sound like you, doesn't, you know that they don't look like you, and they're asking you to give up everyone that you've been in contact with for the last 14 days. That means your close associates, you know, no one really wants that kind of intrusion. But unless you have someone that is culturally competent, that comes from the neighborhood that they're calling, you have a different reaction. You know, you can tell by certain questions, by certain answers, that they relate to you, and so that eases the issue of the skepticism. And so that's what I mean by cultural competency. And I have some friends that actually were hired by DC Health, and that they're right to do so. As a matter of fact, with the Black Coalition, we were trying to organize through churches to provide contact tracers to the DC government. So they're moving in that direction. So that's why I said earlier that they're getting their legs under them, and those are under themselves. And so that's a good thing, but we're not there yet.
So, Dr. Wilcox, since you brought this issue up, so I have found mine. Like I said, I have an iPhone. So if I go to settings and I go to privacy and then I go to health.
Yeah, you're right. That's
and then it comes up. It says COVID-19 exposure logging, and then it gives me the option to turn it on. But underneath it, it reads, when enabled, iPhone can exchange random IDs with other devices using Bluetooth. This enables an app to notify you if you may have been exposed to COVID-19. Exposure logging cannot access any data in or add any data to the health app. I don't know how I feel about that, because Certainly we want people to be safe. I want to be safe, and I know it's a little funny, but also it gives me great pause, because now, as a person who has been socially distant, wearing masks, washing hands, doing all of this stuff, but I also go to the grocery store. I also get gas. I did see my daughter and my parents on Sunday. And so I'm trying to figure out in my head, do I turn it on? Doctor, what do you think?
Yeah, as I mentioned, I haven't turned mine on. The idea of being that closely monitored bothers me too. The idea behind the app, for those who aren't real familiar with it, is it'll be aware of anyone around you that also has a similar app. So the person has to have their app and it has to be turned on also. If that person ends up being tested for COVID and is positive, then they would be able to go back and look at anyone that came in came into contact with that person within the past, say, 7 to 10 days that had their app turned on, and be able to then notify them that they've had a potential exposure, and it would be up to the person to decide to go get tested. So it's not that the government's going to come knocking on your door and say, you've been exposed, and there's not going to be someone standing there in front of your face.
No, they're already in your house because your phone is in your house.
Yeah, well, they are doing that.
I don't know how I feel about this, Mr. Lane. Because based on what Dr. Wilcox is saying, let us say that I have tested positive, and I have not been tested, but for the sake of argument, say I have been, and I have this thing on, and then my neighbor has hers on, and she has not been tested. I mean, is my phone going to go off and say, you can't stand next to Harold now? Because the implications of that sound like the realms of science fiction right now.
Well, what will happen is that your neighbor, you won't get the message. Your neighbor will get the message that you may have been exposed to someone that tested positive for COVID-19 just by the exchange of information by your phone. And so your neighbor won't get who it is. It won't say that your next door neighbor tested positive for COVID-19. It won't do that, but it'll tell you that you've come into contact with someone that did test positive for COVID-19, and you should now go through a 14-day isolation period just to see whether or not you get symptoms. Or it'll tell you that you need to go get immediately tested and then isolate. So either way, that's not really the issue. The issue is the trust in what is done with that information. And we already know that the federal government had to chastise phone companies and internet companies for exchanging our information without our knowledge. That happened during the Obama administration. So why would I think that they would not utilize that information for something else somewhere down the line? And so I know there's a need for the contact tracing, but it can be done in ways where it's not necessarily an app that we can trust, especially when we already know that there are companies that peddle this information.
A lot to think about here. And it certainly, and sometimes I do give my opinion here, but this one, I can't touch. I really can't touch this one. And certainly all transparency, this was not necessarily something that one of the topics during this conversation that I thought we were going to get into. But honestly, Dr. Wilcox, this is incredibly important. This is as important as the mask issue. This is just as important as protecting our seniors, protecting people with underlying conditions, particularly in the African American community, because of the comorbidity issues that have been laid bare during this pandemic. No, certainly. I appreciate the fact that you did bring this up, because this is definitely fuel for discussion. One of the questions I was going to ask you, Dr. Wilcox, in the very beginning that I didn't have a chance to ask you, what do you know now that you didn't know 3 months ago?
Well, there's actually been a tremendous amount of information that has come out. I think one of the most important things is the percentage of people that have the disease that are asymptomatic but still infectious. It's now felt that probably about a third of people don't ever develop symptoms. They're still infectious, unlike what that one person from the WHO missaid. I think all the science really argues that people without symptoms are still infectious. They can still spread it. We don't know how infectious they are, but they can definitely still spread the disease. I think that's one of the biggest things, because a lot of people have felt, you know, without symptoms, why should I be wearing a mask? Why should I even be concerned about that? I'm not going to be passing it. And like you mentioned, really the wearing of the mask is not so much your own protection. It helps you a little bit, but it's really to protect your fellow human beings.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a concern for people as a whole, not just your grandmother, not just the little old lady that lives next door. It's to really, it's public health. It's a way to, it's minimal effort on someone's part, and it can significantly decrease, if you're one of those people with asymptomatic infection, transmission to others. That's, to me, that's one of the key things that we've learned.
Are you flying, Dr. Wilcox?
Not yet. I'm actually thinking about going to see my family in about a month.
And how long of a flight would that be?
It's 2 hours, two and a half hours.
But you said you're thinking about doing it in a month. What is your apprehension?
More so because my parents are in their 80s. And because of what I do for a living, I don't want to be an asymptomatic person who happens to bring it to them. That's really more my apprehension than anything. I don't think it's going to be that bad traveling. I think most of the airlines are requiring masks. And they're supposedly really cleaning the airplanes very, very well in between.
What about you, Mr. Lane? Are you flying?
No. And don't intend on it anytime soon.
So here's that question. What is anytime soon?
I just have to see more. I have to see more in terms of the numbers. I have to see, because the first question is going to be flying to where? And if there are continued hotspots, I'm certainly not going to fly to those areas.
I do answer your question. I agree with that, by the way.
what was that, Dr. Wilcox?
I 100% agree with that. There's no way I would fly to a hotspot, even if my family was there to go visit them at this point. No.
But I do want to answer your question about what I've learned.
Yes, please.
In D.C., you know, wards 5, 7, and 8, which comprise of the most African Americans, comprise of 50% of all deaths from COVID-19. Ward 8 has the highest number of deaths at 20%, and then wards 5 and 7 have 15% of all deaths. But ward 4 actually has the highest number of positive cases. So we know
you're breaking up there a little bit.
Uh-oh.
No, you said Ward 4 has the highest number of cases. You said we know, and then you broke up. Please finish your thought.
And we know that the high deaths are...
I'm going to see... Let me see if my producer can reestablish a better connection with you, because I want to make sure that we get that point. In the interim, I do want to ask you, Dr. Wilcox, about some of the basic things that we've been talking about since the beginning of the pandemic. And one of the things is hand sanitizers and or soap and water. Are hand sanitizers still a good idea? And talk to me about the hand washing thing. Is it still recommended to do the 20 seconds in between the fingers, blah, blah, blah? Is it as effective as we first heard that it would be?
Well, they don't now that environment exposure in terms of touching things is that as dangerous as it was originally thought. It still is considered a possibility of the way of transmission, But we really think the vast majority of the time it's exposure from someone breathing out or coughing and you being in the area at the time that it happens. I still recommend my patients that one thing I do recommend is that they don't wear gloves when they're out in public. The reason for that is if you wear gloves, you're more likely to, you're not going to be washing your hands, for one thing, and you're more likely to accidentally touch your face or touch your eyes or your mouth with a piece of plastic that's been sitting there on your hands for a while. So I actually recommend to my patients that they carry sanitizer with them. They sanitize their hands frequently whenever they're not at home. And that as soon as they get to wherever they're going, that they should go into the bathroom, wash their hands with soap and water. As soon as they get back home, they should do that also. And I tell them, actually, they should change their clothes when they get home, too.
You said they should change their clothes.
I usually recommend that to them, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And well, I appreciate that, you know, the glove piece, because one of the things that I do when, and I found this to be the case, I have gloves in my car. They're, you know, thin plastic gloves, and I don't wear them when I get in the car. But when I go grocery shopping, I put them on in the car, and I'll go grocery shopping. Or if I go to Lowe's or someplace like that, I will put them on in the car. But then when I finish, I take them off. Just as surgeons do, you know, you take them inside out, then you take the one that you took off, you ball it up, and then you take the other one inside out, and you wrap it up, and you throw it away. But I don't keep them on consistently. Good idea, bad idea?
Yeah, that's fine, because you're just wearing them for a short time.
Yeah.
If whenever people wear them at work, and they wear them for 4 hours or 5 hours, that's actually very dangerous, we think. It's much safer to instead just clean your hands routinely. But I think wearing them while you're out in public for, say, 15, 20 minutes while you're grocery shopping, I think that totally makes sense.
And let us say the hand-washing thing, COVID-19 notwithstanding, you got to do what your mama told you. Keep, you know, wash your hands anyway.
Right. There's one thing that we learned, or at least that I learned about a year ago. They did a good study looking at whether you need to use hot water versus cold water. Does it make a difference on cleaning your hands?
Mm-hmm.
And actually, you can wash with cold water, and it's just as effective as hot water. Mm. So you don't have to have it piping hot whenever you go to wash your hands.
Mr. Layton, you were making a point about Ward 4 having the highest numbers of infections in the District of Columbia.
Yes, they are clearly the highest. I mean, D.C. has tested almost 10% of its population. You know.
Gosh, did we lose you again? Mr. Lane.
I blame my carrier.
Okay, go ahead. It could be that app that we were talking about.
It could well be the app. Yeah.
But go ahead and finish your point.
But Ward 4 has the fourth highest number of deaths. Ward 8 has the third highest number of positive cases, but they are first. They have the highest number of deaths. So, you know, when we talk about things like obesity, diabetes, heart disease, when we talk about, I mean, there are certain things that can come from getting COVID-19 too. So you're more prone to diabetic ketoacidosis, more prone to sepsis, more prone, and if you have rheumatoid arthritis or multiple myeloma, it getting COVID-19 makes that worse. And so we need to take it as serious as possible, and it's not going to subside.
We dropped out.
You dropped out again.
But Dr. Wilcox, in the last few minutes, there is another really important question that I need you to, you know, try to address. One of the things that we've been seeing, and there were several reports over the past couple of days about people who have gone through the COVID-19 infection, have come out, but still are having feeling, you know, the impacts. Even though they've been released from hospitals and the like, they're still having problems. Why is that?
Yeah, most people actually recover fairly quickly whenever they do recover, but there are definitely people that have long-term consequences. There's definitely people who have kidney problems that go on for at least a few months that we know of. People have ended up on dialysis. There are people who have lung problems, and we're doing some research at Howard looking at long-term sequelae in the lungs of patients who were ventilated on ventilators. So we know that there's definitely long-term, or at least, maybe not long-term, but at least for several weeks to months. And I've had friends who had severe disease down in New Orleans, that's where I moved here from, that even 2 months out, they still have very little energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A friend of mine is still struggling with that same thing. I've got about a minute. Mr. Lane, I'll let you have the last word.
Well, it's just that we have to take this very seriously. We are certainly, you can go to the Black Coalition Against COVID.org website to find out more information. And I just thank you for being on the call.
Well, I want to thank both of you for being part of this really important conversation. This is not over. And it will take each and every one of us to do our part to make sure that we continue to stay safe as we move toward better treatments and hopefully a vaccine. It's summer now, but that real second wave, as many of the experts suggest, could be extremely difficult, not just for this country, but for the world. So I want to thank you, Dr. Ronald Wilcox and Ambrose Lane, for talking to us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Well, that is the Daily Drum for this Wednesday, June 24th. I'm Harold Fisher. And again, just a reminder, we're having a special edition of the Daily Drum on tomorrow. It will be on the radio as well as on our social media platforms and on WHUR.com. Young, Gifted, and Frisk, the resurgence of stop and frisk policies and young people. Stay tuned for The Connection. Good night, everyone.